revives for Afghans the memory of Afghanistan's national hero, Ahmad Shah Massoud. It becomes more interesting when you understand that both Soleimani and Massoud had friendly ties before Massoud's assassination, only 2 days ahead of the 9/11 attacks.
Lieutenant General Soleimani had a transnational personality. He had close ties and cooperation with our national hero Ahmad Shah Massoud and Professor Rabbani, who were leading anti-terrorism resistance in northern Afghanistan.
Let's not forget that many here in Afghanistan believe the slaying of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was leading regional resistance against terrorists, is not an endpoint in the fight against terror. Rather, his assassination has made the resistance front all the more determined in its campaign against terrorists. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The first person vaccinated against COVID-19 in Austria, an 84-year-old pensioner who says she wants to see her children, grandchildren and great-grandchildren again without hesitation. The first 5 volunteers who received the initial doses of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine included 3 elderly patients with underlying health conditions and 2 healthcare personnel. According to the manufacturer, a certain protective effect should already exist 7 days after the first of the 2 doses is injected. Chancellor Sebastian Kurz and Health Minister Rudolf Anschober, who were present for the vaccinations at Vienna's Medical University, spoke of a historic day.
This is the beginning of the victory against a pandemic and a game changer. We move to normalcy step by step with every vaccination that is carried out.
But the two officials warned of challenging months ahead.
Today marks a turning point, but the fight against the coronavirus has not yet been won.
Anschober said that by the summer, over 4 million doses of the vaccine would be available in Austria, which has a population of almost 9 million. The vaccination is expected to be rolled out in 3 phases, starting with those in high-risk groups, over 80-year-olds and medical personnel in the first few weeks of January, and continuing with frontline workers. And from April, the rest of the population, excluding those under the age of 16. Austria entered into its 3rd hard lockdown on Saturday, with the Chancellor warning against a 3rd corona wave and a massive increase in infection numbers across Europe.
Officials have made it clear that another year of recurring lockdowns is not an option. The hope is that with more vaccinations, that can be avoided. Homa Lezgi, Vienna.
On International Day of Epidemic Preparedness, Gaza's health sector continues to suffer due to the Israeli blockade. Coronavirus infections have skyrocketed in the Gaza Strip, which is one of the world's most densely populated areas. Despite the increasing number of COVID-19 infections, the Israeli regime continues to place tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medicines and hospital equipment. Human rights organizations say Israel's illegal practices have compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for nearly 2 million Palestinians, making it extremely difficult to combat the deadly pandemic.
The Israeli blockade has taken its toll on all aspects of life in Gaza, and especially on the health sector. The health sector is suffering from an unprecedented deterioration due to lack of medicines and medical supplies, as well as trained medical personnel to deal with the coronavirus pandemic.
The coronavirus pandemic has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the blockaded Gaza Strip. The Israeli blockade and multiple wars since 2007 have had a devastating impact on the well-being of people in the tiny coastal sliver.
Our people are suffering because of the Zionist blockade under the watchful eye of the international community. The situation has only gotten worse amid the coronavirus pandemic.
As infections continue to rise, experts are calling for the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade to help fight the spread of the coronavirus.
The humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip is catastrophic and is getting worse by the day. the health sector is unable to provide proper medical care to coronavirus patients and even struggles to provide tests for the deadly virus. Gaza has a population of over 2 million and hospitals don't have enough beds for the patients.
The COVID-19 pandemic remains a serious concern due to the capacity gaps in the enclave's health system.
Hospitals in the tiny enclave lack medical facilities and medicines to tackle the deadly virus due to years of Israeli blockade. Israeli inhumane practices have battered Gaza's health sector since 2007. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
More and more Yemeni civilians die in Yemen on a daily basis amid the continuation of the Saudi siege on the Arab country. Here in the Pediatric Leukemia Treatment Center, 50% of patients, namely children, die due to the lack of medicine and medical care they need to survive.
We've suffered a lot to establish this center so that children could have a chance to survive, especially due to the difficulties of traveling abroad. During the past 6 years, we received hundreds of cases, but the death rate is still high. And we hope that the concerned international organizations will do their role so the children could have a normal recovery.
Hundreds of children come to the center from all across Yemen, as it is the only medical center for such patients, hoping that they will receive the required treatment. However, the ongoing war and the crippling blockade have made the center suffer from a permanent shortage of medicines, medical supplies, and radiation devices.
The families of patients come from remote areas. They also face lack of medical supplies. Also, the treatment for leukemia is marrow transplantation, which is very expensive and is carried out outside the country, which is not possible due to the continued siege and the closure of Sana'a's airport.
I come from Al-Mahwit Governorate, which is very far away, and we face a lot of trouble traveling to reach this center, which suffers from a constant shortage of medicines and overcrowding of patients, as it is the only center in Yemen.
The health sector in Yemen is in a dire need of necessary support from international and relief organizations, which have not played their role in alleviating the suffering of the Yemeni people that began in March 2015 due to the Saudi war on Yemen. Hundreds of children lose their lives at the gates of the center due to the lack of medicines and other medical supplies, as well as their inability to travel for treatment due to its high cost and the continued closure of Sana'a Airport. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
It's been almost 1 year since the U.S. President Donald Trump ordered the assassination of head of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. The martyrdom of Haj Qasem, along with head of the Iraqi Popular Forces Haj Abu Mahdi Muhandis, has had a major impact on the region, and specifically Lebanon. The images on the streets of Beirut reflect the news which became general knowledge after his assassination. His role as a representative of the Islamic Republic of Iran in assisting the resistance was instrumental.
Even Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said this, that he was one of the fathers, the main fathers of the victory of the year 2006. And also what followed after that was the training and the equipment that the Islamic resistance got, that the Israelis are now quite fearsome of.
Hezbollah Secretary General has stressed in several speeches that the U.S. crime will not go without punishment, stressing that the martyrdom of Haj Qasem will only strengthen the resistance alliance.
We admit that it was a heavy blow to our resistance alliance. In this life, it was a loss for us, but God Almighty has kept the family and friends and beloved people of Haj Qasem Soleimani for us. Also, the blood of Haj Qasem Soleimani will strengthen and reinforce the path of resistance.
The leader of Al-Quds forces was seen as someone who united many fronts in the region against aggression.
Things are quite interrelated here in the region. You know, whatever happens in what country reflects on the other countries. So his role was quite major, and the act of the assassination that the Americans did was a sort of not only revenge of certain defeat, but also a revenge against the defeat of their brains by the brains of Martyr Soleimani.
In a gesture of gratitude, one of the municipalities in southern Beirut named one of the streets after Martyr General Qasem Soleimani, whose name has become immortalized, but what many see here as the spirit of martyrdom.
The important thing that we need to focus on from these examples, from the martyrs that are sacrificing themselves, that our ummah, our nation, is always capable of producing more, and people who have the same spirits, Martyr Suleiman's legacy was quite huge, especially with the issue of the spirit of the martyr.
General Qasem Soleimani was not only seen as a friend of Lebanon and the Lebanese resistance, he was considered by Hezbollah's commanders and leaders as a partner of the resistance who played a key role in achieving liberation for Lebanon in the year 2000 and securing victory for Lebanon in the 2006 war. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Israeli warplanes have carried out a wide air raid targeting various positions in the besieged Gaza Strip in the early hours of Saturday. The Israeli airstrikes caused damages to hospitals, mosques, and agricultural lands in the east of the Strip, and two civilians were reported injured. Israel claimed the airstrikes were in response to rockets fired from Gaza.
Targeting civilians in industrial areas indicates that the Israeli army has been encouraged by the recent normalization deals with a number of Arab states to further violate Palestinian rights. But we will continue our resistance against Israeli aggression.
Resisting groups here stressed the Israeli army's crimes over Gaza and targeting civilians amount to violations of international law.
The Israeli army continues to commit crimes against our people. The airstrikes have frightened civilians and led to serious damages. We are facing a violent regime. The resistance, however, we respond in case the Israeli army continues its aggression. Resistance is our only weapon. We have to defend Palestinian rights. Netanyahu is trying to escape from his political impasse by stepping up pressure against us.
Palestinian groups say Israeli army should be held accountable for its crimes. Israeli occupation exacerbated the already dire condition Palestinians are living through, especially amid the coronavirus pandemic.
The airstrikes violate all international laws because Israeli army targets hospitals and residential areas. We hold the Israeli occupation responsible for all the consequences of this aggression.
The Israeli regime often targets the Gaza Strip, citing rocket fire from the enclave. Palestinians here say that Israeli army violates all international laws by damaging hospitals and targeting civilians. They insist their resistance is the only way to cope with the Israeli aggression. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Since the beginning of the Saudi war on Yemen in 2015, Iran has stood by the Yemeni people. General Qasem Soleimani was a key figure in the Yemeni-Iranian relationship with his anti-war stance and support for Yemen's sovereignty.
There was a strong connection between the martyr Qasem Soleimani and the issue of Yemen. He gave moral support to Yemen, which is part of the axis of resistance. Martyr Qasem Soleimani was one of the most important leaders of the resistance, who had a big role in backing countries that confront the global hegemony.
We can see a growing increase of correlation between Yemenis and General Soleimani. For example, the first group of graduates from the Persian language department in Sana'a carried the name of the General Soleimani in their ceremony weeks ago.
General Soleimani is portrayed in Yemen as an important element in the resistance against the Saudi aggression. Yemenis consider him as an example of confronting arrogant powers. He has also become the symbol of a revolution that inspires people to find freedom and dignity.
Yemenis consider him as an example of confronting arrogant powers. He has also become the symbol of a revolution that inspires people to find freedom and dignity.
The martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani is of course a great loss for Islamic nations. However, contrary to what the US has predicted, the assassination of this iconic figure has given a great impetus to an entire generation that is pledging to continue his legacy while facing the enemies. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Resistance figures from Palestine, Syria, and Iraq have marked the first martyrdom anniversary of commander of Iran's Al-Quds force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, in Damascus, recalling his role in restoring stability to Syria. In a gathering, resistance delegates underlined the importance of his efforts in leading resistance in Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, and Palestine.
General Soleimani exerted huge efforts to support Palestinians in Gaza and occupied territories. He had a great role in raising the morale of Palestinians in their fight against the Israeli aggression. He never interfered in the internal affairs of the Palestinians.
We have gathered here to pay tribute to two great leaders of resistance who lost their lives in fight against enemies of our causes. We tell those who want to create divisions among us that we will remain united and strong and will follow in the footsteps of General Soleimani.
On the 3rd of January 2020, U.S. President Donald Trump ordered strikes that killed General Soleimani and his companions near Baghdad International Airport.
Martyr Soleimani led battles in Aleppo and eastern Syria as well as around Damascus. His presence had always boosted the morale of fighters. His presence scared the enemy on the battlefield and at the same time gave power to resistance fighters.
The role of Martyr Soleimani and the alliance of Iraqi, Iranian, and Syrian resistance gave a lesson to the U.S. and its allies that they can't defeat our resistance, especially in Syria and Iraq.
Throughout the war on Syria, the general was a top strategist and military commander, leading Iranian military advisors who helped Syria at its government's request in the fight against terrorists. He frequently visited the front lines in Aleppo and Deir al-Zor and joined resistance fighters for advisement, despite knowing he was a target for the U.S. and its allies. The general also took personal command of the battle against Daesh terrorists in the city of Bukamal in Deir al-Zor countryside in November 2017. For resistance fighters, he was a commander and a father. For Syrians, he was a true friend and a hero. For the Syrian army, he was a brother and an ally who was there whenever needed. And this is how Martyr Qasem Soleimani will be remembered in Syria. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Afghan First Vice President Amrullah Saleh says there would be no peace and stability in Afghanistan unless regional and international players establish close cooperation in this regard. Addressing the second meeting of Afghanistan's National Reconciliation Council, Saleh also said the war in Afghanistan is fueled by certain sides which benefit from war.
Every single weapon or technology used in Afghanistan war comes from outside. So considering the intra-Afghan talks as the only way to bring peace to Afghanistan is naive. We need to take into account the external dimension of Afghan conflict as well, which is highly important.
Afghan officials said they are committed to bring peace and security to the war-ravaged country via negotiations and urged the Taliban to pay heed to the demands of people and approve a ceasefire. This is while a sharp increase in violence has shocked the entire nation and even prompted the UN body in Afghanistan to react. This comes as media workers, political activists, and government employees have turned into the most frequent targets for assassination, mainly over the past 2 months. According to Afghanistan's Interior Ministry, over 50 individuals, all of them media workers, political activists and civilian employees of government, were killed and over 70 others were wounded over the past 2 months. So far, regional and international players like Iran, Pakistan, as well as the UN have pledged commitment to help Afghans in different fields such as peace and democracy.
Governments also have a positive obligation to take all necessary measures to ensure the protection of everyone against violence, threats, retaliation, discrimination, pressure, or other arbitrary action that is taken against them as a consequence of his or her exercise of human rights. There should be no space for impunity.
The calls for collective efforts to bring peace to Afghanistan comes as the intra-Afghan talks are set to be resumed on January 5. So far, the Taliban has not yet approved a ceasefire. Now, many in Afghanistan hope the new round of talks could pave the way for peace in Afghanistan. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The floating sulfur reservoir north of the port of Hodeidah, which carries a million barrels of crude oil, poses a great environmental risk since it has not been put under any maintenance since the beginning of the war on Yemen. Recently, an agreement was reached between Sana'a and the United Nations to maintain the reservoir. Sana'a has already signed the agreement, while the UN is still stalling until today.
The Ministry of Foreign Affairs facilitated the entry of technical experts for the maintenance of the safer tank, as it was agreed upon in July. But we were surprised by the United Nations postponement of the operation to February next year, and we do not know about the reasons. We hope the United Nations will expedite the dispatch of maintenance teams for the safer tank, because if a leak occurred, it would constitute a major disaster.
The Supreme Economic Committee confirms that the United Nations has not yet signed the agreement and surprised everyone by delaying the arrival of experts until February 15th, which could cause a disaster because the water had already entered the engine of the tanker, threatening it to sink or explode.
The United Nations is using the safer oil vessel as a pretext to impose political and economic pressure on the government of Sana'a. The Saudi-led coalition, on the other hand, has also used the tanker to implement its own agenda, despite greater dangers that also threatening the Suez Canal.
The delay of the maintenance operation, as well as the continued detention of oil ships by the Saudi coalition, has led to an oil derivative crisis from which Yemenis have been suffering for months. This has also reflected negatively on the health sector.
Experts confirm that the sinking of the reservoir will cause an environmental catastrophe from which Yemen will not recover for more than 30 years until it gets rid of the dire consequences of contamination. The crisis will also cause the extinction of millions of marine life from the Red Sea. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a, Yemen.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime and the United Arab Emirates have been working together to eliminate the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, without solving the issue of Palestinian refugees, French newspaper Le Monde has reported. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by the staff of Middle East Eye website. This article is published under the heading Zionist regime and the UAE working together to eliminate UNRWA. That's according to a report. Here is the details of this article. The Zionist regime and the United Arab Emirates have been working together to eliminate the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, without solving the issue of Palestinian refugees, French newspaper Le Monde has reported. According to Le Monde, This process has been underway since the Israeli regime and the UAE announced normalization between the two regimes in August. According to the report, Emirati officials are weighing up a plan to gradually eliminate UNRWA without making it conditional on a resolution of the refugee issue. This is despite the UAE having been a major funder of UNRWA in 2018 and 2019, along with Qatar and Saudi Arabia, to offset U.S. President Donald Trump's halting of funds to the agency, which had brought it to the verge of bankruptcy. The U.S. had cut its contributions from $360 million to $60 million in 2018 and then down further to zero for 2019. At the time, Pierre Cronbull, then UNRWA's Commissioner General, had condemned the U.S. withdrawal of funds. At stake is the dignity and human security of millions of Palestine refugees in need of emergency food assistance and other support in Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Cronbull had said in a statement, addressing the alleged plans by the Zionist regime and UAE to eliminate UNRWA, Le Monde journalist Benjamin Bart tweeted out part of the report, which read, "In doing so, Abu Dhabi would be rallying to a long-standing demand from Israel, which insists that the agency is obstructing peace by nurturing refugees in the dream of returning to the lands from which their parents were driven in 1948. UNRWA was established 7 years ago to supply aid to Palestinian refugees, and its mandate is renewed every 3 years. Trump's administration, along with the Zionist regime, accuses UNRWA of perpetuating the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. In October this year, the Zionist regime ambassador to the United Nations, Gilad Erdan, claimed that textbooks used by schools run by UNRWA contained insightful content demanding that the UN end the incitement and anti-Semitism in UNRWA schools and publicly pledge to eliminate any terrorist infrastructure in its buildings. UNRWA disputes such accusations and says that the services it provides would otherwise not be available to Palestinians. The agency was set up in the years after more than 700,000 Palestinians had been expelled from their lands during 1948 Zionist regime occupation. It provides schooling and medical services to millions of impoverished refugees in Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria, as well as the Palestinian territories. While the main UN agency dealing with refugees, UNHCR, concentrates on their voluntary repatriation or local integration and resettlement, UNRWA maintains millions of people as refugees in the long term, expanding the numbers year after year. Last November, the UN General Assembly approved the extension of UNRWA's mandate for 3 years, a week after Cronbull had resigned over a UN ethics report which alleged mismanagement and abuses of authority among senior officials of the agency. Afterwards, the Zionist regime had called for UNRWA's closure. The ethics report claimed that since 2015, members of UNRWA's inner circle had been consolidating their power, but that the situation escalated from the beginning of 2018, coinciding with the U.S. decision to remove its funding, serving as an excuse for an extreme concentration of decision-making power in the members of the clique. The report further claimed that these developments led to an exodus of senior and other staff and a work culture characterized by low morale, fear of retaliation, distrust, secrecy, bullying, intimidation, and marginalization, and management that is highly dysfunctional, with a significant breakdown of regular accountability structure. Much of the report focused on allegations surrounding the conduct of Cronball, who took up the post in March 2014, citing a range of alleged corrupt and unprofessional activities. In June 2019, Cronball had expressed concerns about the impacts on Palestinian refugees of the Trump administration's approach to the West Asia region peacemaking. There is no doubt that last year, a combination of the announcement on the U.S. embassy move plus the funding cut to UNRWA that created undoubtedly significant levels of anxiety among Palestinian refugees, Cronball had told reporters in New York. Shortly after details of the UN ethics report became known, the Netherlands and Switzerland suspended their funding of UNRWA. They were followed in August 2019 by New Zealand.
The debate.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kaveh Tafwai. The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement, resistance movement, has said that Israeli efforts to prevent the group from obtaining precision-guided missiles have failed. Now, this comes after Israel threatened to target a Hezbollah arms facility. At this point, the question comes up, why is Israel ramping up this kind of pressure on Hezbollah at this time? Furthermore, is it even capable of dealing with the sheer power of Hezbollah? In this edition of the debate, we will take a look at the Hezbollah Secretary General's warning of how it is capable of striking any location in Israel in retaliation for any Israeli adventurism that may occur. But first, let's find out more about this story from our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, who joins us from Beirut. Well, Mariam, at this point, we have seen the threat coming from Israel, and the Hezbollah Secretary General has made his stance clear. Can you tell us more about this?
Well, it's definitely not a new threat. We've had these threats for years, of course, especially in this realm and after the 2006 war. But one thing that's very important that Said Nasrallah mentioned that was when the Israelis, there's just a loud voices, we just have the psychological warfare. This is not real actions. We're not talking about real actions here. It is because they are incapable right now, because they know that there are more than 25,000 rockets. And we heard this, we have this from the Israeli media. They're sort of, you know, weeping their stance that they cannot take action. And if they do take action, it will be detrimental for their presence, of course. So this is why the Israelis are stuck. And all that they have right now is just to launch one threat after the other. On the other hand, Hezbollah does have the capabilities to launch precise rockets or other rocket types of rockets anywhere in occupied Palestine, any area. And they have mentioned, Said Nasrallah has mentioned in many speeches, in addition to this interview, that Hezbollah can target any single area or facility, whether it is for the government or for the military, in the entire geography of occupied Palestine. So that is one thing that is very important to keep in mind. And the Israelis will continue, of course, their threats. And Hezbollah said they are also they want to retaliate for their fighters that were martyred inside Syria. This is another issue that is keeping Israel on high alert. So this is one, in addition to its worries, they have an additional worry where they're trying also to get this out of hand in some way, trying to create these scenarios where they would just say that there was an operation, Hezbollah launched it, and then that's it. Hezbollah has already retaliated, whereas Hezbollah, until today, they said they still have not retaliated. And we're still waiting for that operation to take place.
Okay, thank you for that. We appreciate it. Mariam Saladar from Beirut. Let's bring in activist and political commentator Leith Maruf, who joins us from Beirut. Leith Maruf, first let's take a look at the Israeli threat, who has threatened to target a Hezbollah arms facility. But why do you think that Israel is making this kind of a threat at this time?
Well, it's threats that are empty because yesterday Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah informed us that the response to the Americans and others that relayed the information to the Lebanese government asking it about a facility in the Bekaa Valley, that Hezbollah responded whether there is or there isn't any Hezbollah activities in this facility in the Bekaa Valley, that if it's targeted, that they will retaliate on a location of similar value, meaning they will hit some military facility in Israel with precision missiles, guided missiles like cruise missiles that right now Hezbollah has access to. So in reality, what we see is just threats being made. Much has been revealed yesterday in the interview in terms of the capabilities of Hezbollah for any future military confrontation with apartheid Israel. And we can discuss that more if you want.
Yeah, we will. Michael Springman now joins us. He is a author and former diplomat who joins us from Washington. Michael Springman, welcome. Michael Springman, maybe, I know that we know what this tension, why the tension exists between Israel and Hezbollah, but perhaps you can tell us what it is that Israel is after when it comes to Hezbollah. Why is Israel and Hezbollah, in a sense, arch enemies?
Well, Israel, the apartheid entity, sees Hezbollah as a arm of Iran, and Hezbollah is blocking its efforts to control Lebanon and to control Syria and to do their very best to destroy the operation of the countries in any way possible. And they see Hezbollah as a enemy that could be used against them. It's like the Bibi Netanyahu and Iran's atomic weapons. They all exist in his head. And Hezbollah is no threat to anyone except to whoever attacks them. In the past, the Israelis were thrown out of Lebanon because Hezbollah fought them fiercely and inflicted casualties upon them to their great surprise. So I think that they want to get rid of anyone that stands in the way of controlling the entire region. And Hezbollah and Iran and Syria are forces and countries that will not knuckle under to Israeli aggression and Israeli diktats about how things should be done in the region.
Well, Leith Maruf, why don't you tell us your point of view when it comes to Israel and the way that targets Lebanon. I mean, we know, for example, it violates Lebanon's sovereignty several times a day. The last figures I'm showing here, within the first 5 months of 2020, the Lebanese government registered over 1,000 Israeli violations of Lebanese sovereignty by land, sea, and air. So doesn't that give Hezbollah a right to be somewhat on alert, even though Israel violates Lebanese airspace so many times, numerous times?
Definitely, and this is the reason of existence, the reason of the thought of Hezbollah and the resistance in Lebanon, that apartheid Israel is continuing to occupy land and sea and violate the airspace of this country as if there is no sovereignty or international law. So yesterday, beyond the declaration by Mr. Sayyid Nasrallah about the possible response to an attack on the facility in Al-Biqa Valley, we had a clear revelation that Hezbollah had doubled its guided missile stockpile, smart missiles and cruise missiles, just in the last year. So that means that whatever the Zionists were trying to do in terms of cutting off the supply of Hezbollah from Syria, it didn't succeed. Secondly, we heard another bombshell, which was that Hezbollah had targeted multiple Israeli drones over the last year. Some of them were shot down, some of them were chased away in the air by the air defenses, and some taken over by the electronic systems, and that this was not told to anybody before. The reason was that it was just some hints to the Israeli army to know, military, to know what capabilities are at the hands of Hezbollah. And since then, we heard also that all Israeli drones that have entered the airspace of Lebanon since those hidden actions that Hezbollah did have been flying at a much higher altitude and only with escorts of F-16s to protect them, to hit back at anything that targets them. And finally, we heard that Hezbollah has the sea defense systems that can hit any Israeli warships or oil and gas facilities that could encroach on Lebanese sea, international waters, the Lebanese waters, and you know the debate that is happening right now on negotiating on the territory and the water for the gas reserves that are there. So those are huge disclosures, and we know definitely the Israeli media was covering them all day.
Well, Michael Springman, in many ways, the U.S. Has presented Hezbollah to the world through its media arms and Western media organizations in general that it's the bad guy and has labeled it as a terrorist organization. And, you know, our guest here has quite rightly described all the different types of ammunition that is at hand for Hezbollah. But the reason that Hezbollah has the ammunition that it has, I talked about the violation of the Lebanese airspace. But it's the type of threat that Israel has posed for the country of Lebanon, because with Lebanon without Hezbollah would no longer, by many analysts, be a Lebanon. It would be Israeli territory, because Israel would, by their accounts, come and invade Lebanon, perhaps. So, and not to mention how Hezbollah is part of the Lebanese government. So therefore, what I'm trying to say is that, you know, it's not Hezbollah who's the bad guy here. It's the provocative actions by Israel, if you agree.
Oh, exactly. Hezbollah exists to defend Lebanon and to defend Syria and act as a forward defense of Iran, from what I can see. And the Israelis want complete control of the region. They don't want anyone in the area to have any armed forces or weapons that can hit back at their provocative, illegal actions. That are essentially murder, war crimes, and human rights violations. And as long as the Israelis can get away with this, they're happy. The Americans back them. I think the American State Department even listed Hassan Nasrallah's son as being a terrorist. It's on their list now. But you never see the any of the Israelis being on the American terrorist list, despite what they've done to Lebanon and what they've done to Syria and what they're doing in northern Iraq and elsewhere. So I think it's basically the best defense is a good offense. The Israelis and their subordinates, the Americans, are basically doing their best to direct everyone's attention away from what the Israelis are doing and their illegitimate entity there on the banks of the Mediterranean. And if the Israelis were held to account, if the light of day were really shined upon them, the country would, if it's a country, really. Would evaporate.
So, Leif Maruf, you talked about all the different assets that Hezbollah has, such as these precision-guided missiles. You talked about some of the sea assets that it also has, amongst other things that show that Hezbollah is not the same Hezbollah that it was back in 2006. That it is more advanced. That it has an arsenal that's more complete, and has added to its arsenal throughout these years. So, and I think you mentioned that Israeli threats are pretty much hollow. What would it take for Israel to act? Would there be an incident? Because we know that Hezbollah has still said that they are going to, for example, take revenge for one of their fighters that was killed in Syria by the Israeli airstrike.
Definitely. Yesterday, Sayyid Nasrallah referred to this situation. He said that up to now, Hezbollah is very satisfied with the apartheid army standing on a leg and a half, as they said, basically waiting in the corner for their punishment, withdrawn from most of the forward bases on the border. He referred to the fact that it's been now multiple times that the IDF sent drones that are, you know, not drones as in planes, but remote-controlled vehicles that had in them mannequins to pretend that there's somebody there to give Hezbollah a target to hit and then defuse the situation. We've seen that earlier this year also with that, bomb-diffusing robot that had a mannequin on it. He said that this has happened multiple times over the last few months, and that Hezbollah's fighters are ready to hit these targets, but they have the orders to verify a living being inside any bases or vehicles before they hit them, because Hezbollah doesn't want to lose this advantage of the deterrence that has kept the Israeli army on standing on one leg for the last 5 months. And so, as you know, what is expected, as Mr. Nasrallah told us yesterday, is as soon as the Israeli army lifts down some of its high emergency posture, there will be a response, and there will be a clear equal to the assassination of a Hezbollah member. Before that, there will be no response. It's not the bang that Hezbollah is looking for, but the actual deterrence and the actual action inequality.
Well, Michael Springman, we are looking at the last few weeks of the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump, I think, until he is actually out. Some people still have doubts. Even Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has called Trump angry. He's used that word, and he's called him crazy. So, by crazy, I'm guessing that he thinks that Trump, together with Israel, maybe are calculating some kind of military action. Am I correct to read Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah's thoughts on this way, do you think?
I would say so. There's an awful lot of talk going around on the internet and emails and even the some of the mainstream press about what will really happen between now and the time Joe Biden takes office January 20th. And the suggestion is that the Israelis and the Americans will look at one more chance to strike at Iran, to strike at Iran's the organizations that Iran is advising and assisting, and in between administrations and over Christmas, New Year's, when the American government is virtually dysfunctional, although it's been like that for the last year since the virus, I think that they would see this as a great opportunity to strike and escape any kind of punishment, because people are too concerned with New Year's or too concerned with getting Washington ready for the Biden administration. So I think Sayyid Nasrallah has some feeling for this.
Okay, and I'm going to address the same question to you, Leif Maruf, because Nasrallah did say that. I don't know if I should use the word concern, but he certainly called Trump angry and crazy. Do you think they are looking, Israel and perhaps the U.S. together, looking at some type of military action?
Well, Sayyid Nasrallah yesterday informed us that they are on highest alert up until the transfer of power that may happen. You see, he actually said that he's not sure that Trump is going to leave, and he laughed when he said that. We also know that Sayyid Nasrallah revealed yesterday that Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, in his first meeting with Trump in the White House, demanded that Trump assassinates Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, and that Trump approved it but said that Israel will be the one implementing that assassination, which MBS, Mohammed bin Salman, responded to by saying he's ready to cover the cost of the assassination operation and any damages that happened to apartheid Israel. So we know that there is serious direct possibility of an assassination attempt against Sayyid Nasrallah in the last next 20 somewhat days that are left of this administration. And the resistance here in Lebanon is taking it seriously, and I'm sure the rest of the axis of resistance in Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen are also on highest alert.
Well, indeed. And Michael Springman, that brings me to the question that I left somewhat for the end of this program, and that is how Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has repeated vows that Iran and its allies will avenge the U.S. killing of the commander of Iran's Revolutionary Guard, Qasem Soleimani, which happened in a drone attack a year ago in Iraq. And Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah did say, quote, that revenge is coming, no matter how long it takes. Do you think that's going to be sooner than later, or at a later point?
No, it's really hard to say. I don't have a crystal ball or a gypsy fortune teller, but I would say I would, for a certainty, that there will be retaliation, and it will be a time and place of Nasrallah's choosing, or Iran's choosing, or whoever will be doing the acting's choosing. It's the longer they wait, the more anxious they get, and the sloppier they might get in their thinking and in their defenses. So I think it's to the advantage of the people striking back to wait and make people wonder where and when and how, and chase around looking for boogeymen under the bed and trying to strengthen and protect everything they possibly can, which is impossible to do. You can't defend everything in the world. So I if I had to say later than sooner, I would say later.
And same question to you, Leif Maruf. Do you think that this very serious statement and posturing, I should also say, of the revenge that Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has talked about, Iran's leader and many high-ranking Iranian military officials have also stated that, will happen sooner than later, or will it happen at a later time?
Well, yesterday, Sayyid Nasrallah quoted Ayatollah Khamenei and said that everybody who is responsible for planning, ordering, and implementing the assassination will be held responsible, will be, and is a target, and specifically said even Trump is a target, and that those who are of free will around this world, the free peoples of the world, individuals, movements, and states, will be working towards that. So, for me, I expect that after